ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Anthony Burke here, host of By Design on ABC Radio National, a show about the clever ideas and human stories behind the spaces, systems, and objects shaping everyday life. Whether you're curious about architecture, interior design, fashion, or anything in between, we reveal why design matters in a rapidly changing world. By Design on ABC Listen.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal Land. I'm David Marr. Germany decided after the slaughterhouse of World War II to ditch its role as a great military power. It was always safe enough under the NATO umbrella, but with Russia on the march, the politics of peace in Germany have been transformed. Later, we're looking at the impact of this great change on Germany, Europe, and the world. We'll also be given a lesson from a master spin doctor on the strategies politicians employ to prevaricate and lie and get away with it. We're opening a window for Late Night Live listeners alone on the politics of deceit. But first, to Britain, to Ian Dunt, and a Prime Minister hanging on, despite Fleet Street pumping out his obituaries. Ian, welcome.
Hello.
Hey, why is he still there? Why, after the latest humiliations of the Mandelson business, is he still there?
I think ultimately, because the people who would wish to replace him don't feel that now is the right time for them to do so. And the figures in Labour who would orchestrate that, basically the parliamentary party, aren't convinced enough by them yet to think it's worth the punt. It's not really because anyone sat there with a tremendous amount of hope and aspiration for Keir Starmer anymore. And that's mostly because, and that's sort of his own doing. I mean, strategically, with Morgan McSweeney, his former chief of staff, who has now gone, but who orchestrated his political strategy, they sort of targeted their supporters one by one for punching. You know, they just sort of lashed out. You know, liberal wing, the left wing, the soft left of the party, the centre. There was hardly anyone in the Labour Party or within broad progressive circles that they hadn't actively gone out one week to try and alienate in order to secure votes on the right, which they never got. So when you just decimate your support within the parliamentary party, it's kind of not surprising there's no one there to support you. And the only reason you managed to stay in place is because they're not yet convinced of the people who would replace you.
There's nobody of any great stature waiting there to be the next Prime Minister of Great Britain, is there?
Stature is too ambitious a word. And I think, you know, Britain politically has to sort of learn to sort of make do with slightly lower benchmarks for success. So there's three main people who are lining up who want the job. And they're all, I think, probably more impressive than Starmer, or at least they have attributes that mark them out and that make up for some of his failings. On the right, there's a guy called Wes Streeting. Young, he's a gay guy, he's very pro-city, very, you know, pretty free market, very, very interesting life story, came from a, you know, pretty hard knocks background. He is extremely eloquent in media appearances. He's genuinely quite funny. He's articulate, and he represents the hopes of the sort of Blairite right of the Labour Party. On the left, his opposite number is Angela Rayner. I mean, a really interesting and impressive politician. Sort of, you know, single mum from a very, very young age, grew up on a council estate. Everything about her is unusual. I mean, you'll see her vaping she vapes all the time. You know, when she's on holiday, you'll see pictures of her at a rave, or you'll see her looking hungover in a boat. She could sort of be like the kind of left-wing Labour version, I suppose, of Boris Johnson, except that she actually has convictions and some sense of consistency to her intellectual views. And then somewhere off to the side, you have Andy Burnham, who was a former Secretary of State under New Labour, went off to become Mayor of Manchester. He's called the King in the North, typically when he's referred to. He was a sort of robotic presence under New Labour. And yet something happened to him in Manchester when he became mayor, and he became this extremely articulate, authentic version of himself, able to summon up this sense of local identity with an ease in his communication and some actually really quite deep thinking about politics. So look, they're all too young, and you know, they're not the kind of people that you'd call political giants, but they are all right, left, or something else, got attributes that make them more interesting. And I mean, that people might have a little bit more ambition for them than the current leadership of the Labour Party.
You talked a moment ago about pursuing votes they're never going to get out on the right. And and you mentioned in some writing you were doing the other day, an absolutely splendid move on the part of the Home Office. The Home Office has banned asylum seekers using taxis to get to medical appointments. Why?
Oh, for no, I mean, just no reason on God's earth. They, I mean, these policies, I mean, it's, you know, there's like a few million a year that are spent in, you know, unusual circumstances, because the thing with asylum seekers is the government bans them from working. You don't have to do that. Plenty of countries allow asylum seekers to work. And then if they fail in the asylum claim, then, you know, they have to leave the country. So obviously they won't be working any further. There's no reason on earth to stop them working. And in fact, it costs the country much, much more money because they're unable to earn for themselves, those that don't have pre-existing funds. And you have to provide them with accommodation, with food, with, you know, electricity, with everything else. It just, it's punishment for the domestic population as much as it is for the asylum seekers, who are kept in this poverty-stricken limbo for no reason at all. So then occasionally, if they have an extreme medical condition and there might be an unusual circumstance, you get a taxi to take them to a medical appointment if nothing else is possible. That's now been banned. The arguments that are used for this are always, well, we're trying to reduce the pull factor. You know, we're trying to prevent people from coming over here because they think, I mean, it, do they honestly, I just don't know if they realize how insane they sound when they say, do they honestly believe that there is someone in Afghanistan who is sat there thinking, you know what, I won't try and flee the Taliban because they've no longer got taxis for asylum seekers, you know, in the UK. It is just an inconceivable policy. But of course, it's not there to be enacted. It's not actually there to work. This is the crucial thing to understand about Westminster policymaking. These ideas are not put forward in order to actually make a difference in the objectively existing world, the empirical world that exists outside of our mind. They are there to win newspaper headlines, nothing more. Like, there is no other function to them being put forward. So the attempt is to say, well, look, maybe we'll get some favorable coverage in the Sun. Maybe we'll get some favorable coverage in the Mail. You know, any of the kind of right-wing rags, which incidentally, no one actually reads anymore. I mean, this is essentially a media, even if you were to accept the cynicism of it, it is a media strategy that was designed in the late 90s when people still read newspapers. Now, those newspapers have a circulation that is just falling through the floor. And yet we will still pulverize and brutalize asylum seekers in order to secure headlines in newspapers that no one reads, with the full knowledge that it would make no difference if the policy were enacted. So that is the reason that they passed it. And is literally, if a person behaved in the way the British government did, we would consider them to be morally and intellectually insane.
The bigger point you make in that piece, which impressed me so much, is that Starmer was tasked to run a government that would save Britain from populism. And you write, instead, it is handing it to them on a f***ing plate.
Yes, and that's my writing style that you don't usually refer to on the radio.
We have to be authentic here, Ian. We have to be authentic. I have to quote exactly what you've written.
Yes, I mean, it's a more aggressive form of language than I tend to use on your programme. It's more the sort of post-10pm version of me. The basics of that are correct. He had to demonstrate competence. Like, the key idea behind this administration was, we have to show people that our way works. Like, that mainstream retail politics, rationality grounded in evidence, passing policy to improve people's lives, that it works. You know, that to get lost in culture war and identity and race and immigration is beyond any moral qualms. It's a waste of time. and is a waste of capacity that is supposed to be directed towards improving people's lives, improving health services, you know, making it possible to get housing when you're young, reducing the cost of food, improving literacy and numeracy, the things that actually make better lives, rather than the popular charade that all it does is divide people and provide them with nothing. It won't put food on the plate. That was Starmer's job, to show that boring, competent government works. And that means passing policy that matters and that does have an impact in the really existing objective world, not just getting lost in this turgid dream cycle of Westminster and journalistic nothingness. So there you have it. I mean, you know, when you put someone like Mandelson in charge, I mean, to give you the example, he replaced someone to make Mandelson the ambassador. That someone was Karen Pierce, the sitting UK ambassador to the US.
Extraordinarily competent, in your view.
Absolutely. I mean, a lifetime of service in the Foreign Office. She'd worked all over the world, a serious, weighty figure. Anyone that met her was struck by her. She knew exactly how to pitch the language. She'd made sure she'd built her support bases on the Democrat side, on the Republican side. She knew how to do the job. Hugely experienced, very serious woman. Then Mandelson comes along, not a single accomplishment to his name, not a single accomplishment to decades. I mean, basically to, you know, 50 years of being in politics without anything to show for it, except a string of scandals, all on the basis of his friendships with very wealthy men and a pre-existing and well-known scandal about his association with a known paedophile. He comes along and says, you know what, I'll do it, but I won't actually do it full time because I also want to have this job in the University of Oxford. So I'll do it part time. So now we know, like, the gender calculation for the Starmer government is that one highly experienced woman is worth the part time of a man who, you know, socializes with paedophiles and has no accomplishments to his name. So on that basis, you just think that's not a serious government decision, is it? That's not the kind of thing a serious government that wants to kill populism does. That's the kind of thing a clown car government does. And clown car governments feed populism. They don't kill it. They feed it. Now, when Keir Starmer came to power, the first thing he said was, we are going to kill populism and we're going to do it through a sense of national duty and competence. And that sense of national duty and competence is nowhere to be seen at the moment.
On Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking, as I do regularly, with Ian Dunt, our man in the United Kingdom, columnist for the I paper. Meanwhile, the High Court has handed the Starmer government a gigantic embarrassment by saying that they should not have declared an outfit called Palestine Action a terrorist group. And thousands, it's over 2,000 people have been arrested now, haven't they, for holding placards saying, I support Palestine Action, because that's been taken to be the work of terrorists.
Well, I don't think, to be honest, I don't think anyone was particularly surprised by it, because the decision to prescribe them as a terror group seemed to go so completely against any normal idea of what the word terrorism means. Now, like Britain, actually, like other countries, although not all countries, does have an ability to say that serious property damage can count as terrorism. And this group were engaged in serious property damage. Like, you know, they were on the furthest end of what you would call kind of direct action. And it's more than just smashing a few shop windows. It's kind of like industrial damage. But then, of course, the thing is, you can charge them with property damage. Like, go ahead. You know what I mean? Because that is the offense. That is what they are doing. And technically, the government thought they could get away with prescribing them as terrorists. But for almost everyone, including most people on the right, and you just sort of thought, like, well, that's not what terrorism, that's not terrorism as we understand it. You know, terrorism as we understand it really does, we do sort of consider that involves loss of life, or at least threat to life. In this case, that simply wasn't there. And the cynicism with which the government pursued this, I mean, they bundled together the vote on Palestine Action with two sort of far-right Nazi groups, so that, you know, any MP who voted against prescribing Palestine Action had to also vote against prescribing these Nazi groups. It's just, you just think, like, what a grubby, irresponsible way for you to behave and for you to conduct yourself on a matter that is really quite grave and quite serious.
But you ended this splendid piece of yours, which I urge everybody to read, with what you took to be good news about Britain. for all the hypocrisy and disappointment and grim chaos this week, you found something pretty wonderful there as well. What?
Yeah, this is true. This is a rare moment of optimism, which I try not to express in public too often, but sometimes it has to happen.
You'll swear in public, but not express optimism. Yes, go on.
There's some things that are just unseemly. You look at the US. I think all of this applies to Australia as well. You look at the US and you just think, like, Trump was clearly close to Epstein and no one's even touching him. You know, people that were just deeply embroiled in this and they're not touched because it's so tribal and there's no sense of universal value, holding things up of a universal moral value. I think when you look at the UK, and again, I would include Australia in this, you see that there's still that sense of a universal moral value. And how do you see it? You see it because, not because people on the left attack the right for their moral failings, and not because people on the right attack the left for their moral failings, but because people on the left attack the left for its moral failings, and people on the right attack the right for its moral failings. Now, that is what we've seen in the Manderson case. This is a story that was broken. I mean, it's broken on Blue Sky, not on X. It was a story broken by journalists at the FT in liberal left circles, holding a government that was governing in their name to account. And lots of people would then say, you know, well, the right has gone completely off the reservation and doesn't do this anymore. Now, you see, I don't think that's as true. I think that's certainly true in the political class in Britain, but it's not true in the public. Now, you look at what happened with Boris Johnson during Partygate. You know, he basically lost control of the Conservative Party because he lost his voters. Those voters stuck with him, right-wing, conservative, reactionary, pro-Brexit voters. They stuck with him for a long time due to lots of misbehavior, and it came to Partygate, and they sort of went, no, you know what, I'm not putting up with that. He came under attack from the right. The attacks from the left didn't matter to him at all. It was from the right. Now, those instances, what you're seeing with Manderson, what we saw with Partygate, that is the existence of universal moral codes that apply irrespective of whether the person you're talking about happens to be in your ideological tribe. And that is the stuff that civilizational political standards are based on. And for that, at least, you know, when you have it then here and you look at that scandal play out and you look at how that scandal is not playing out in the United States, and you think, okay, you know what? There's something to be pretty satisfied with there.
Ian, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you.
Next time we speak, it will be face-to-face in the studio in Sydney. I can't wait. It's going to be a confrontation. All the politeness will be over, Ian. It's going to be it's going to be pretty rough in a fortnight's time. Can't wait. Coming up, Deutschland rüstet auf, Germany rearms. After the war, Germany resolved never to be a great military power again. But then came the Cold War, and West Germany rearmed modestly under the auspices of NATO. A strong peace movement survived beyond the 1990 reunification of the country. But roll on 30 years to the Russian invasion of Ukraine, and the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz pledged to provide all the financial resources the Bundeswehr needs to become Europe's strongest conventional army. To discuss this huge shift, not only for Germany but Europe, we're joined by Michaela Kufner, Chief Political Editor of Deutsche Welle and co-host of the English language podcast Berlin Briefing. Michaela, welcome to Late Night Live.
Pleasure to be on.
Michaela, last weekend you were with Chancellor Merz at the Munich Security Conference. What was his message to Europe and to America?
Well, there were two key messages which were really new. First of all, it was that the Europeans, and he was making clear that he was speaking for the Europeans, wouldn't stand for the MAGA culture war. So it really was a direct standing up to Trump's America, or his idea of America. And at the same time, he spoke of a more independent Europe. And he spoke of the continuing dependency and Europe being at fault for having allowed for that dependency to come into being in the first place. Of course, the Europeans are fully dependent on the United States when it comes to defense in NATO, and it was a recognition of that. But it was an end to what critics, he himself would never call it that, described as appeasement, essentially trying to go along with Trump as far as necessary to contain his anger, his wrath. We saw this over tariffs. The Europeans struck a deal that wasn't advantageous to them, only to then have Donald Trump start claiming Greenland for US security. And after successfully pushing back, it looks like the Europeans, particularly the German chancellor, have now mustered the courage to stand up to this Trump administration, even when it means not just a political risk, but even a security risk for the Europeans and specifically for Ukraine.
Do they really use the expression appeasement, appeasement of Trump?
That's what the critics say. This is what was rejected throughout by any European politician. But they know that they struck a disadvantageous deal over tariffs. They were walking a delicate balance between standing up for European interests without risking support, particularly over Ukraine. Ukraine is part of Europe. It's part of the European defense. And of course, it's that country which gave up its nuclear arms in exchange for signatures from the Russians and from the US and from the Europeans that they would maintain their borders, that those wouldn't be challenged.
Was there any nation in Europe that so depended on the NATO umbrella as Germany? I mean, that's what kept Germany safe, was it not, at a time when it was essentially refusing to rearm?
It was refusing. This is part of the deal that was struck to allow Germany to reunify between East and West. This was also partly a German concession for reunification. At the same time, there was no appetite in Germany to rearm, to let its army grow again. In fact, it reduced its army, it slashed its army down after German reunification in 1990. And it abolished conscription. Now, there is a country that is more dependent. I would cite Poland. It has a direct border with Russia.
Yes.
It's much more vulnerable territorially. It will not seek nuclear weapons. There's a non-proliferation treaty. So there are legal boundaries that this is not possible. But even, let's leave the nuclear aside for a second. I'm sure we'll get to that in more detail. But Germany is the largest economy in Europe. And it has now suddenly gone again to becoming the fourth largest country in terms of spending on weapons after the US, China and Russia. So that really is quite a historic shift. But there simply was no appetite here in Germany to become a military heavyweight again.
Why was that? Was it regret for the war, a sense of the waste of the Second World War?
Well, the First and the Second World War are deeply ingrained, not just in the historical thinking here, but also in how Germans think about themselves. And I think it's really highlighted by the reintroduction of a military service. We don't have conscription again. I think it's really important to stress that. It's based on voluntary participation only. That's just come back into force over the recognition that Germany must build a much bigger and much stronger army to be able to defend itself. Today, Germany simply would not be able to defend itself. This is an admission that politicians here had to make. Now, just imagine that in Australia. I guess the Prime Minister would have to resign if he or she had to admit that Australia is not able to defend itself.
It would be
so
hard.
So this dependency, yes. And this dependency emanated from the end of the Second World War, the conditions that applied after German reunification, but also Germans' understanding of themselves. Now that we have this voluntary military service again, there's a very heated debate over sending young men basically into the line of fire. There seems to be little concept of a military that is there and ready just in case anymore. So we have a very heated debate here and a very emotional debate. And this emanates from our understanding of ourselves as the aggressor in the past here in Europe, and also the understanding that has been broken with that the United States are here to help always. And that was the experience of people who grew up just after the Second World War, that the Americans were here to protect us from ourselves, but then to also protect us from Russia, potentially, and the whole Soviet realm. And now that we see Vladimir Putin wanting to, what he sees as fixing a historical mistake, this left the Europeans, but particularly Germany, literally unguarded and not able to muster the manpower, the equipment in time to be able to be a credible threat for Vladimir Putin's appetite in the future. So we still need the Americans. And this process of letting go of the certainty that the United States will help us and building it up an army of ourselves is really a fundamental rupture in how Germans saw the world.
At the time of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, Lieutenant General Alphonse Mace took to his LinkedIn account and wrote, "The Bundeswehr, the army that I have the privilege to lead, is more or less broke." How broke was the army? How under-equipped was it when this great shift began?
It was so broke and under-equipped that when you spoke of German tanks, there would be a huge differentiation between how many tanks do we have and how many are actually ready to roll. It was so broke that the German Chancellor back then Olaf Scholz, on the Sunday following the attack on Ukraine, gathered a special session in Parliament. I was there, and declared, having barely consulted with his coalition partner, the Greens, out of all, the which are in part still very much pacifist, that he would dedicate 100 billion euros extra for long-term investments into the German military. At the time, the defense budget was hovering around 50 billion. Now the aim is to reach 100 billion per year by 2028. And there is essentially now a blank check on military long-term spending. Germany can at any point in time, without breaking with its own budget rules, which were very tight in the past, make long-term investments if it feels it needs them. So, and that's also why all eyes are on Germany, because Germany has the money at this moment in time.
They can
take on debt.
Sorry to interrupt you. They can afford to do this, which is remarkable. They have the money.
Well, they did have it sitting around. They have the willingness to take on debt. And just to give you a perspective, the German budget is just between, you know, in the past years, it was between 450 to 500 billion euros. That's the federal budget. That's not the state budgets. Now, having 100 billion euros in defense spending is quite something.
When will the army be up to strength?
This is a question that we regularly ask the defense minister here, and the aim is 2026. But what I've heard on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference is that the question of what ready means is being perceived as a fluid one. They are pointing to the fact that, particularly when it comes to artillery ammunition, which was most needed in the context of Ukraine, was needed fast, it's still needed fast. Here, Germany, the Europeans as a whole, were really able to ramp up production. That's a real success story. And they're now exceeding the capacity of the United States. But there's many other areas like air defense, where the Americans basically have the system that everybody needs, and which is also an integral part of German and European defense. Germany hasn't spent much time thinking about national defense. When it comes to any kind of military engagement, also abroad, it is legally bound to do that with other countries. It's never allowed to act alone. This is also emanates from our past. And that's why the whole thinking in terms of military was always a cooperation, thinking in terms of NATO, but also the coalition of the willing supplying arms to Ukraine. It's always a multilateral thinking. So 2026 is the short answer, but it's been stressed to me by people very high up in the Bundeswehr that this will be faster or slower, depending on the area, without them willing to specify which one.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Maher, and I'm talking to Michaela Kufner, Chief Political Editor for Deutsche Welle, about the rearmament of Germany. Michaela, you spoke earlier about voluntary service with the new Bundeswehr, but there are also plans, are there not, for conscription. How would the politics of conscription work in Germany? Certainly, the experience of conscription in other countries has been that it has led to profound hostility to military service.
Well, the novelty now is that after conscription was abolished years ago, there's been a reintroduction of military service, which is voluntary. So from the 1st of January this year, every 18-year-old, men and women, received a questionnaire in the post. Constitutionally, it's only the men who have a legal obligation to reply. And so far, the Bundeswehr, the German military, says they're confident that they will be able to meet their needs of some 25, 30,000 recruits per year through those volunteers. If they are unable to do this, this is what's been agreed between the coalition partners, then there's a willingness to reintroduce conscription, which would then include a duty. Now, I was told that we're far off that, and that they're still literally, I mean, we are in February now, they're looking at the numbers and they're not really willing to give us actual trends. So far, they say they're confident they can meet the requirement, but they say, let's just look at this for a couple of months. If they're not able to get enough recruits voluntarily, then there's a political will to introduce a law, which would then mean there's a legal obligation. At the same time, because Germany completely abolished its recruitment centers over the whole this whole conscription infrastructure.
So they've got to rebuild those as well.
They have to rebuild it. Well, actually, it's really interesting because they're thinking about, you know, this is a separate story, but you know that the centers of towns are dying, the big department stores are dying. Well, they're looking at where they can rent now, and we may well see these department stores that are now empty revived as recruitment centers for the military, which I think is a very telling image of how Germany is changing, if that really happens. But they're still looking at real estate. As soon as I hear of the first department store being turned into a recruitment center, I'm certainly going to be down there looking at that, because I think it's just so interesting. It's just so telling. It's such a manifestation of how society is changing. And but there simply also isn't the capacity in terms of people who can train recruits. There were stories that really made the German military laughing stock that they didn't have enough guns, so they were literally taking broomsticks to practice out in the field, running around with guns. Yes, it's really so. This
but
is
for all this,
issue.
Michaela. For all this, they are speaking about getting up to strength next year.
And well, here we're talking. Yes, but hold on. These were individual reports, but which were very much emphasizing a point about a lack of equipment. Now we've seen a complete boom of the past 4 years. The starting point for all of this, of course, was the attack by Russia on Ukraine. And the troops are getting better equipped. At the same time, it's an add-on if you want to train more recruits for the future. It's also an add-on that there is training happening for Ukraine. Interestingly enough, the warfare of the future is more likely to be drone warfare. There's a recognition that Ukraine now has competencies that German European armed forces don't have.
All this is in the shadow of the invasion of Ukraine. But how dangerous is Russia to Europe? if it can't sweep through Ukraine?
Well, we could have an argument whether the real danger is Russia in its current shape or form, or the fact that the United States continues to question NATO, and that the United States may pull out. Even without a war in Ukraine, the signals coming out of the Trump administration, and to be fair, it was also previous administrations who criticized the Europeans for not doing enough for their own defense, for their own security. This will not bounce back. There is a recognition that if Trump were not to be, he's not going to be reelected anyway, but even if the next administration completely changes course, that will not mean the United States spending so much money on defense in Europe, although still the majority of the politicians in the House consider Europe to be part of the United States security infrastructure. So coming back to Russia, Russia is really economically at a stretch. There is a consensus here that economically draining Russia, that's why there's still more and ever more sanctions, is the way to go. Because militarily, Russia has the strategic advantage, which is terrible, that it simply doesn't seem to care about how many Russian lives are lost on the battlefield. And so the cost doesn't really place that the human cost is not part of the equation for Vladimir Putin. And that makes it hard for Ukraine. There were intelligence services in the Baltics who don't perceive Russia to being an acute threat for them. That's interesting, because that's where Russia would be expected to strike first. But there's no immediate concern that there could be a full-blown European war beyond Ukraine. At this moment in time, let's get back to the Munich Security Conference. I've been there for a decade now. There was always talk of wake-up calls for Europe. This was even before Trump won. But now everybody is fully awake and is actually taking action. And the times where there was talk over, oh, we should do more, oh, we should align better, those times are over. There's a recognition that politicians now need to act on that. The Europeans are often their own worst enemies because they're not unified, and they can't really unify behind particular projects, but they have all recognized that whatever happens, whether Vladimir Putin continues to go the way he's going, or if there's complete chaos in a world post-Putin, that Europeans will have to be able to protect themselves against a country which, after all, Russia is a nuclear power.
Michaela, thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Great to talk to you.
I have been speaking to Michaela Kufner, Chief Political Editor for Deutsche Welle and host of the English language podcast Berlin Briefing. This is Late Night Live. Listen to this. Anne Arley, the other day, being quizzed on RN Breakfast, doing what politicians are coached to do, not answer the question.
Do you welcome President Herzog's visit?
Well, President Herzog was invited in the aftermath of the Bondi attacks, as is protocol, and as is what something that is usually done, and an invitation is extended where there is an attack where foreign individuals have been the targets.
Do you welcome the visit?
I think, as I said, he was invited as part of to commemorate and to remember the victims of the Bondi terror attack.
Will you be welcoming him? Is this a welcome visit?
He was invited for the Bondi terror, for the victims of the Bondi terror attack, and that is protocol, Sally.
Maybe she's been in the game so long she doesn't need coaching, but perhaps she does need a little more, because always available to politicians, really around the world, are professional spinmeisters who teach politicians how to lie if necessary, prevaricate where possible, not answer questions and stay on message through thick and thin. Toby Ralph is one of the masters of that profession. Toby, who worked for years for the Liberal Party and as a campaign director in over 40 elections across three continents. Now, in case you fear he's a Liberal hack, here are a few lines from a piece he wrote in Crikey late last year about the Coalition's 2022 defeat. Unpopular policy, dodgy research, unlikable leadership and misguided campaigning conspired to gift Liberals an egregious case of self-harm. Women, ethnic communities, the university-educated, the young and inner urban voters were repulsed like magnets in a science experiment. Toby, welcome to Late Night Live.
Well, how very nice to be talking with you, David.
Toby, I take it you were not advising the Liberals in the 2022 election.
I was not. Had they paid me, I'd have written something very flattering about it, because, of course, I'm a liar for hire.
Can we have an undertaking from you that you will answer my questions today?
Well, that's an interesting question, David. And as I travel this great country and talk to ordinary Australians...
Stop it.
Hard-working
Stop right there. What do you think of Ann Arley's performance?
Look, I think it was slightly clumsy. She could have done better, but...
What should she have done?
Well, I can give you, if you want, a six-point strategy that you should follow if you're being pursued on detail.
Okay.
The first thing you've got to do is, if you're asked a question with facts, you've got to reframe it morally. You've got to try and turn facts into values. If you're asked detail, you talk about what matters, not about numbers, because they can't catch you on that. That's fluid, as they say. The second thing you do is, if they're asking you an awkward question, you answer the question you wish they'd asked, because that's all they can report. They can only play back what you say. If they keep pressing, if they go hard on that, you zoom out until the detail evaporates. You know, you talk about the big picture and history and context and global forces and complexity, and ultimately that means it can't be anything to do with you. If they're still at it, if they're going the full Sarah Ferguson on you, you want to then talk about process. You invoke process, not outcomes. So you're talking about reviews and frameworks and consultants and consultation and timelines and everything but a quantifiable outcome. You want to do that. And what that does is demonstrate activity without consequence. And if by then you should be at the end of the interview, and you just close with a confident statement about what you want to say and get out of the studio.
You are a citizen. You are listening to Ann Arley over your breakfast. What do you conclude about Ann Arley's attitude to the visit of President Herzog?
She just does not want this fight. Her attitude wasn't clear. I don't know what she thinks, but I do know she's terrified by being seen to be committed one way or the other.
Okay, all right. Now, look, can I be your client?
Because, certainly. You know, I'll get the bill drafted up immediately.
Yes, start the clock ticking, because I'm in some trouble. I'm the premier of a state. There on television is footage of cops breaking up a group of Muslim men at prayer. What's more, at prayer that the police leadership on the scene, the police leadership had said they were free to do. Right, so I am the premier. Now, what should I do? Should I apologise?
No. You should be unapologetic. You should obfuscate as much as you possibly can. Talk about the complexity. Talk about the community and how we want strong community cohesion here, and that the police have got a complex and difficult job to do. You will have a full investigation into it, of course, but the police have your confidence. That's as far as I'd go. I would then start sending out other people, because it's not an argument you want to buy into, because it's a no-win situation.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Toby Ralph, marketeer, spinmeister, former veteran campaigner for the Liberal Party, about how to get politicians through tricky situations. You mentioned a word a moment ago, which I think is fascinating in all of this. The word is complex.
Yes.
Now, tell us about the power of claiming something is complex.
Whenever you make the complexity call, What that's really saying to people is, you're going to be bored by this. You don't need to worry about it. We're handling it. Go away. If it's complex, yes, I might have to make some compromises. Yes, I might have to do some things which are slightly awkward and that you might not understand, but that's because it's complex. And don't you worry your pretty little head about it, because you've got more important things to do.
But there's another use of the word complex, isn't it? Mm-hmm. When there is a very plain situation, something in plain sight,
yes,
and you stand there and say, you stand there and say, I'm thinking of an example, you stand there and say, we're not taking over the West Bank. It's complex.
Yes, it's exactly so. Exactly so. That is. Let's go. Can I go to right? Can I just talk about the nature of truth for a moment? Is that all right, David?
Or, we do that a lot on Late Night Live, and we welcome it.
Okay.
I'm not sure whether we'll believe Toby Ralph on truth,
but I can counsel you not to. Okay, so truth is a really interesting thing because we tend to regard it as an absolute, and it's absolutely not. The closest, I think, I'm an expert witness in several large court cases, and when I'm there, my job is to tell the truth and the whole truth and nothing but the truth, and I do. Strangely, it makes me feel slightly dirty, David. Mm. But the even that is a curated truth, because there'll be a KC on one side and one on the other asking me questions where they're trying to shape my answers. So even in that context, truth is curated. At the other end of the scale, I work as a marketer and propagandist and advertising bloke. What we tend to do is find while there must be truth in advertising, we'll find a scintilla of truth and build a great cathedral of bullshit on top of it. And so much of that is excluded fact. So, for example, I might tell you this hamburger is juicy and delicious. What I won't tell you is that it'll make your kids fat and probably give them cancer later. But you ask most advertising people and they'll say, no, we tell the truth. Truth is a very complicated thing. We don't have the language here to deal with it. But the Russians do.
Now explain this.
So Russia has multiple words for truth, just some of them. So for example, pravda. We've all heard of pravda. Pravda is like the moral truth, what feels right and fair. Then there's istina, and this is, death is istina. It's the absolute truth, like it or not. It's a slap in the face truth. Then you have verno. This is correct. It's the right answer, as in the right answer from a spreadsheet. And the most interesting one for me is vranyo. And vranyo is a lie. Everybody knows is a lie. But everyone plays along so they can move along. And so Russia has a complex language, and there are more words as well. Russia has complex language to deal with it, and we don't in English, which is intriguing. And so when we find ourselves in a post-truth era, we tend to struggle with it, and we tend not to classify it appropriately. We tend to say, well, we tend to bifurcate. We tend to say this is either true or false. And no, it's more complicated than that.
Which of those Russian categories would the statement, I won the 2020 elections in a landslide? where does that come on the Russian scale of truth?
That is Vranyo with a capital V. that's extraordinary. Of course, that our dear president is a master of that, which is interesting because it does go to that post-truth thing, doesn't it? It's sort of the post-truth era it's not about is this true or false. Increasingly, it's about, does this narrative fit with my worldview or not? And the fact, whether it's true or not, is becoming irrelevant. And I think that's for a couple... Am I talking too much? I think that's for a
You're
couple
here to
of
talk.
Reasons. Okay, I'll keep on chatting then. I think that's for a couple of reasons. I think the media changes we've seen have had an extraordinary effect on society and how we deal with truth. I mean, just in Australia, we've got a $20 billion advertising industry which supported, apart from the 8 cents worth of ABC, it supported newsrooms and journalism and investigations and all sorts of things. That revenue went to people who hired journalists. Now, those newsrooms are collapsing. 60% of that revenue has already gone to social media, who care more about eyeballs and ears and outrage. Algorithms that keep you on their platforms, they don't really care about truth. So you're driving division through that, through those algorithms, and you're stealing the mechanisms of, well, it's stealing the mechanisms of journalism and investigation and veracity from mainstream media. And so I see social media as a major, it's a cancer on the infrastructure of truth in this country, and it's had a profound, profound impact, I think.
But, Toby, do you think... This is, look, it's a hunch of mine, that Australians are much more concerned about truth than Americans. That Americans, Americans is this land of belief, anything can be possible, but that's not an Australian view.
No, I completely agree with you, although I think we're sliding the way of America. Again, you know, returning to that newsroom thing, if you think, you know, now newsrooms have a lot of junior journos, not many senior journos, and there are 3.2 public relations hacks for every journalist that in this country. In America, that's over six. So we're traveling down that path. You know, news is increasingly curated by people who provide the content because busy journalists and underfunded newsrooms can't afford to do it.
Is one of the things that is changing the role of politicians and the role of people like you teaching them how to cut through, how to address the public, that news services are broadcasting less and less of a politician's speech? Not so long ago, you'd hear a paragraph of the speech. Now you get a quip.
Yeah, exactly. You're talking about three-word slogans. The world's busy. People are already consuming 30% more news, in quotes, than they were 2 years ago. But the news is unverified and messy, and so much more of it comes through social media, which is unchecked. The people don't engage. The media is quicker, is faster, and it's more crowded. And to stand out when you're a politician and you're saying something fundamentally uninteresting to most people, you've got to put it in three words: stop the boats, whatever it may be. You want a slogan that you can say, repeat, and people will remember and agree with, and then you move on. People in a TikTok age, people can't absorb stump speeches. You can't get a paragraph in there. You've got to simplify it and dumb it all down.
Like Angus Taylor yesterday, shut the door.
Shut the door, indeed.
Yes.
Indeed.
Stop the boats, eat the onion.
Yeah. Wear your hat.
Toby, who is the most feared interviewer in Australia for politicians?
There are two really feared interviewers. Sarah Ferguson is one, and the other person is Adele Ferguson.
Okay, why?
Because they're attack dogs. They will not let you go. So they're dangerous players.
Okay, Toby, let me end with a really late night live question.
Okay.
Wouldn't we all just be better off if we said the truth?
Absolutely not. David, I would be out of work. How dare you suggest that? So what an impertinence.
Toby, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live and being, up to a point, so candid.
A pleasure.
I've been talking to Toby Ralph, strategist, marketeer specialising in persuasion. And that's the show. On our next, we look at the fate of the 32,000 men and women from nine Pacific nations and Timor-Leste who work in Australia. The scheme is a great success, but dogged by reports of workers abused and underpaid. They need help. Plus, we're talking to a critic of the gay revolution, gay himself, but he reckons it's time to rein things in. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.